4. 5 days of floating, and then water stopped being water. The cold river thickened and grew blue, but still not blue enough and not nearly thick enough. This was good news or bad. The immortals offered conflicting opinions along with evidence that always seemed starved, which was the inevitable problem. Orbiting war machines had hammered their little streak ship. Nothing but their crash vault survived the landing. Sensors and other fancy tools would have been invaluable if only they could have been salvaged. What they possessed was one heavy backpack with a survival kit on board. The fist-sized reactor was powering a Remora-built factory, food and pure water delivered without fail. The kit also supplied lights in the darkness, and for one of their ranks, medical help. Everything else was done by the smart fabrics. Clothes and boots, boats and shelter. Honestly, if the immortals were a little less brilliant and a little more shrewd, they would never leave their homes. Shirts and trousers could march into the unknown universe, ruled by some very strong underwear, of course, with gloves and boots ready for the really hard shit.
"You're laughing," Rococo said.
"I am," Amund agreed.
Mir was kneeling below them, studying the boundary between normal water and what was alive. The living rivers were built from protein weaves, concentrated salts, and dissolved metals, giving the bodies their characteristic density, the irresistible mass. That's why the wild river flowed over the blue flesh, and the flesh drank what it wanted for the next few hundred meters, which was the point where the wild water was swallowed up and gone. Amund and Rococo stood on higher ground, accompanied by a knee-high forest of blue-gray toadstools that weren't toadstools. Little winged beasts were resting nearby. They resembled bats, but perched like birds. Not alien, so much as wrong. This ecosystem was simple, weedy, and inefficient, but the living river was close. Its blue body was viscous and warmer than the surroundings, promising that it had recovered from the firestorms. The immortals were assuming that the river was conscious, which was a good sign, Mir claimed. Rococo claimed. But that didn't mean that this was the same river that spoke to the great ship, promising planets and moons. In some fashion or another, that creature was a casualty of a very peculiar war. A long while passed, and then Mir finally stood, gesturing to her colleague.
"Wish us luck," Rococo said. "I'm stupid," Amund said. "But I'm not superstitious."
Laughing at that, Rococo set down the pack and walked down to join Mir. The two of them spoke for a moment and then walked together without walking together, working their way downstream. Amund tried to lift the pack and kit with one hand and couldn't. He barely succeeded with both hands and his back. This world had too much gravity, which was another reason to feel endlessly tired. After age, that is. The pack was hyperfiber mesh doctored to look like old canvas. Amund made a request, triggering small motions inside, and he reached beneath the top flap, his hand closing around an edible flask filled with a flavored water. Then he drank the chilled sweetness before eating the exterior like an apple. The immortals continued their hike, and Amund tried to think about anything besides them. The antirad patch riding his neck began to itch. He scratched at the irritation. Machines didn't care about radiation, certainly not at these background levels. But without the patch, Amund would die in a matter of months. And without the filters moored inside his windpipe and lungs, the over-oxygenated air would poison him in minutes. This was a landscape populated with survivors, and that included one extremely fortunate human. Another laugh, and without the help of mood enhancers or alcohol. What a day. A final piece of honest ground allowed the two machines to stand beside the gelatinous blue. That's when a historic conversation commenced, or there was no conversation. Either way, they spoke to the river, and nothing happened. Mir and Rococo offered words, and nothing changed. And nobody should be surprised. The captains had taught this world the ship's common language, but that was before the carnage. That was before most or all of the original river boiled away. This new creature might be as ignorant as a baby. They might have to start from the beginning, teaching the baby how to talk and what to think about them. And superstitious or not, it was hard to ignore the luck required to reach the return ship and reach it with time to spare. That first streak ship was Amun's home for too many years. He never liked it and always dreamed about escaping from it. Yet there were moments, baffling, frustrating moments, when he caught himself grieving for that frail machine. Salvation. That was their nickname for the return ship. Standing like a mechanical hill, like a castle of superior hyperfibers and fusion engines, Salvation had landed years ago. It set down on a small coastal island. The onboard AIs were always awake, busily sending out promises that the machinery was healthy, fueled, and eager to help. But those giant engines were configured to launch directly into space, not rise slowly and then conveniently set down beside them. Half of the continent needed to be crossed. There was no other way. And without a wild river to ride, this living river had to help. Otherwise, the walk would take months or years to complete, and long before that was done, the great ship would be unreachable. And Amund would most likely be dead too. 1,000 obvious causes offered themselves. Accidental falls, self-inflicted wounds, cancers born from myriad decaying atoms, or inevitable age. But not Mir and not Rococo. Even marooned on this broken world, their modern guts would learn to digest the native organics, and the fallout would cause nothing more than odd, beautiful blemishes. Standing together or apart, the immortals would be able to watch the stars slowly shuffle positions in the night sky. 300,000 years later, the great ship would come back around, and those two machines might still be standing here. Except for little changes wrought by the experience, they would be the same machines. And blessed with perfect memories, they would have the power to see Amun's face and hear his voice, remembering every word that he shared, as well as his bitter little laugh. In that fashion, the human would be kept alive long after his time. The sun moved today, and the machines didn't move. What was human about them looked bent-shouldered and worried.
"We're screwed," Amund muttered.
Then came a slight pressure. The patch on his neck was being touched by a finger, but not his finger. And with the pressure came heat, not scorching, but distinct and out of place. A voice was behind the finger.
"You,"
it said. Not a man's voice, not a child's. Female, perhaps.
"What about me?" he asked.
"A pure river."
Amund began to turn, but several warm fingers grabbed hold, fixing his head where it was.
"Who's a pure river?" he asked.
"You are?"
The voice was close, and she sounded scared. Except nothing about the voice could be trusted. A vast, strange, and utterly gigantic creature was projecting noise for the same reasons that anything spoke to anything. To be understood, and hopefully, to manipulate her audience.
"You are the pure river,"
the alien said.
"You are the undiluted true river that came from the stars to join us."
A few words, and one man's life shifted.
"That's how I look to you?" asked Amund.
"How you look. How you are," she reported.
Then a long blue digit appeared beside his head, jointless and rigid and very thin. What wasn't a real finger was pointing at Mir and Rococo.
"Machines,"
she said.
"My companions?"
"You call them machines."
"So, you've been watching us, have you?"
"Since your arrival,"
she warned. This surviving trickle of a river had an unsuspected reach. Studying them through the flying bugs, perhaps? Amun smiled at the news, feeling nervous and alive.
"What do you think about those two machines?" he asked.
"They terrify us."
That deserved a good laugh, but Amun stifled the reaction.
"Why are you scared?"
"They attacked us."
"Did they?"
"Yes."
"But how did they attack you?"
he wanted to know. Silence. Holding a hand to the sun, the pure river cut the glare in his eyes.
"What weapons did they use?"
"Poison,"
she said.
"I don't understand."
"Poisonous beliefs," she said.
Amun nodded politely, understanding nothing. The blue digit was retracted.
"Those dangerous machines down there," Amun said. "They're hoping to reach that second starship. Which leads to the question, are you going to help them?"
"No."
"No?"
"They are dangerous, and I won't help them."
Amund lowered his hand, sunlight burning his eyes.
"Believe it or not, you sound like the pure little rivers I grew up with."
"How do I sound?"
"Like a cowardly little puddle of piss," Amun said.
The giant river said nothing.
"Those monsters don't scare me," he added.
And after that, Amun felt as if he could take his time, sitting quietly while deciding what he wanted most, and then finding the very best way to make it all come true. 5. Bold action or bolder inaction? Those were possibilities, but only once. Only at the beginning and for a ludicrously narrow moment. Ignorance was the chief problem, but there was also a reflexive sense of duty, and at least in Rococo's case, thousands of years of hubris stirring him to action. Those living rivers were a grand mystery, and mysteries always generated curiosity. The actual voyage promised to be a routine haul across empty, well-mapped space inside a proven machine. The diplomat had survived wilder dashes through space. It was the target world that was unique, barely studied, and unlike anything else. But at least they had the long voyage to prepare. In that light, the plan felt reasonable. Where the rivers live promised to maintain its high-density broadcasts. The great ship would continue studying their target and send updates. Even better, Rococo and Mir were the best two for this work. And the third member of the crew was free to offer odd insights as well as his skeptical silence, qualities that Rococo appreciated more and more as the journey unfolded. The midway point was reached without incident. Telescopic data from home remained enthusiastic, but of course, those were old images growing even staler when they traveled back up to the streak ship. The direct alien transmissions were a few years old, but younger with every breath, and they offered updates about every subject. Industrial growth and half-finished star drives, plus some exceptionally precise measurements about the world's general enthusiasm.
"Bullshit," Amun refused to be confident. "Pictures and noise," the Luddy warned. "Those aliens shape the data however they want."
Naturally, every broadcast was a staged event. That was true when humans threw shadow puppets up on their cave walls, and it was certainly true about the rivers as well.
This could all be a con job, Amund said.
Rococo didn't believe that. There was no great deception. AIs analyzed the feeds, proven algorithms raking the data for lies and signs of madness and any other flaws. Because every lie carried telltale flaws. But this was a long-closed society opening up to a greater world. The evidence said nothing else. Inspired by the great ship, those ancient rivers had decided to reach into space. To help their prospects, they were giving away four of their worlds, but that left plenty of other cold moons and comets for them to claim and then transform. They were 2 years out, and nothing had changed. Nothing was wrong. Not a sign, not a rumor. But in mid-broadcast, the largest river stopped transmitting, and within minutes the rest of that world had fallen silent. A full day passed without words. Mir was working with the shipboard telescopes, trying to boost their sensitivity high enough to get a good glimpse of what was happening. But before she finished, the voices returned. Except they weren't voices. The scarce and weak and urgent transmission showed them nothing but wordless imagery. Every river had been struck by fusion weapons. The aliens were boiled on the land and shredded under the ocean. The diplomatic mission was dead. Every agreement lost. And Rococo realized that years ago, facing a choice, the bold, brave, and exceptionally wise decision would have been to do anything but go on this fool mission. I should have strangled my curiosity. He said that to himself and the others. Obviously, telescopes and automated probes could have done the necessary research, and today the three of them would be sitting safe inside the great ship, watching a distant world burn itself to a cinder. But of course, this was where they were. Trapped inside a streak ship whose engines were punching at the universe. There were zero choices. They were on a collision course with disaster. Nowhere else to fly. Mir and Rococo continued studying the rare broadcasts. Preferring to ignore awful news, Amund remained inside his cabin for days at a time, appearing only to hear a few specifics. And even though he had little experience with aliens and very steep barriers to learning, the man did try to make sense of what was happening.
It's greed, he declared. The rivers got selfish, and some of them went to war with the others.
Rococo and Mir shared a glance. Reading faces, Amund said,
Unless I'm wrong, and I know you're not shy about telling me that. It's not war, Rococo said. What then? Did two big rivers get into a brawl?
The Luddy had made another obvious, very human mistake. War and brawl were two good human words, and deceptive. Rococo had the same problem. He couldn't reliably explain the situation, and that's why he smiled at the exobiologist, saying,
Tell our friend his mistake.
Oh, I was wrong, too, she offered.
It was sickening, this abundance of ignorance.
If I'd studied those first transmissions more thoroughly, Mir began, or better, if I'd taken the trouble to model the river's biology, I could have seen the problem. If I'd made all the right assumptions, which I probably wouldn't have done, but let's pretend I did.
When Mir spoke, Amund stared at her. Even when the topic was too new and too complicated, the mortal appeared to be intrigued by whatever she had to offer. And when Mir wasn't speaking, the man would watch her face and watch her hands, waiting for that inevitable moment when those odd, oversized eyes glanced at poor idiot him. And with the same sturdy resolve, Amund kept ignoring Rococo. The most obvious drama in the universe was the Luddy's hatred for the other male on board this one-lady ship.
This isn't war, and this isn't a grudge match, Mir was saying. The blast patterns, the transmission patterns. And both of you, pay close attention. Look at the flow in these videos.
Rococo focused on the images, but he wasn't sure what he should be seeing. He and that other fellow were on the same footing, both spellbound by the tiny woman who was explaining how thoughts and planning crept their way through each of these great rivers.
The speed of belief, she said.
Thousands of years old, and Rococo had never heard that expression.
What the hell is that? Amund asked for both of them.
The speed of belief, she repeated. One river acts like a single organism. It moves and speaks as if it's unified, which is very reasonable. We know its thoughts are quick. Chemo-electrical speeds, hundreds of kilometers in a second. The largest river can react to any outside stimulation and every interior need. Resources pulled from the crust. Reserves tapped for projects deemed suitable. Like its desire to build starships. The rivers claimed that they didn't see the need before us. They barely had enough curiosity to build giant eyes and watch the universe. And what did they see out here? Tiny creatures gathered around lesser stars or riding inside ridiculous little spaceships. And a lot of empty, cold space, too. But then the rivers saw us. They saw the great ship. Here was the first genuine marvel. 1 billion years old, and the organisms had finally found their superior. And because of that, they made promises to do everything possible to gain passage on our grand home.
She paused, returning Amun's gaze. Did he understand any of this? The man was sitting up, which was unusual. But this was an important, sit-up-worthy moment. That body would never adapt to the high G's, yet he never complained about aches or the occasional cracked bone. Rococo held some uncharitable opinions about Amund, but despite being doubtful and sullen, the man never quit proving that he was also an exceptionally tough mortal.
What does that mean? The Luddy asked. The speed of belief.
Mir glanced at her colleague.
Would you like to explain?
You'll manage so much better,
Rococo said instantly. The portrait of gracious confidence. He had no interest in trying to convince the others that he knew what he was saying. Mir nodded and thankfully continued.
Belief isn't thought, she said. And belief isn't a reflex either. What we believe is woven into our nature, and regardless of how we act and what we say, we can never kill the voice that says, this is what should be, and the rest of it is wrong. And the principle of belief, well, that can be far, far more important inside giant creatures. Vast minds have to work around their size and sluggish reflexes. That's why convictions are something held everywhere at once. 1 million tons of neurological matter is infused with complex expectations and stubborn faiths. The river has one mind, yes, but not a mind we would recognize. Spread yourself across thousands of kilometers, trillions of tons of stubborn water. That's what I think we're watching here. At some level, the rivers decided to embrace this new existence, building industries and reactors and tremendous new machines. Except nothing was decided. One belief had the power, and that power was wielded right up until the contrary belief decided enough was the hell enough.
Rococo stopped her. Lifting a hand, he said,
Wait, that last transmission, the one that got cut out in the middle.
Mir nodded, smiling grimly.
The largest river was sending us some very detailed plans, he said.
plans for the conquest of its solar system, including construction of a 100-billion-kilometer-long river that would spiral out from the sun. A living river thriving inside cultured diamond and fusion light.
That might have been the trigger,
Mir admitted.
A fantasy of dream and high physics. And it was too much. Too crazy. Too wild. Too dangerous. There's no being certain here, but sure, that's why the conservative beliefs had enough and panicked. One daydream, and that's what nearly killed this world.
Amund was relatively young, not particularly gray, and carrying those boyish eyes. But his voice had always been older than his appearance, more lucid, and far more thoughtful than Rococo might have expected. Speaking plainly and slowly, Amund said,
"This giant mess. What we're flying toward. You're claiming it's because some voice or voices told a story nobody else liked?"
Mir stated,
"I don't know."
Then,
"But I believe that's possible. Yes."
There was a joke here, but nobody laughed. Glancing at Rococo, Mir's expression grew even more serious than before. Something new had to be shared, perhaps something that she just discovered.
"What else?" Amund asked.
"What else?" Rococo echoed.
"There's another belief at work here," she warned. "I can see it in the last few broadcasts. The rivers that are alive now. They don't just simply hate the deal made with us. They're acting like they don't want to allow us to come close. Maybe we're contaminants, or we're a disease. Perhaps we're even monsters."
"But you are all those things," Amund said. "Didn't you know?"
The immortals tried to laugh, and the Luddy grinned while saying nothing else. Closing her eyes, Mir examined the latest data. Rococo couldn't shake that crippling premonition of being doomed.
"Their world's mangled," she reported. "But there's enough organization and industry left to throw new satellites into orbit. Right now, my best look is showing me a single pusher star drive powered by 100 megaton charges. It's orbiting close to the sun. Judging by its orbit and its focus, I'd guess that it's watching a specific piece of the sky. The piece of sky that will fall out of. And it could be used to intercept intruders. Which is nobody except for us."
Their engines surged, or Rococo was suddenly weaker. Either way, he felt his legs folding, delivering him to the cabin's floor.
"Any more splendid news?" Amund asked.
"Actually, there is good," she said. "The rivers tried to attack our other streak ship. I don't know how many bombs were launched, but what's the difference between a comet approaching at half-light speed and a fusion charge bearing down at a few thousand kilometers per hour? The difference is that bombs are easier to stop. Lasers tore them apart. Only a few detonated, and those at a distance, and the streak ship's armor is too high-grade and proud to shatter."
She paused long enough to sigh.
"Our salvation ship claims to be ready to launch, and that's what I would make it do now. I'd launch it now and have it meet us and save us. If I could get the orbital motions to agree. But the motions don't work and never will. The one blessing we have is that if we survive the megatons, and if we live to reach the surface, and if we happen to be in walking distance too, well, then we have a viable way home."
One of them was destined to die soon, regardless of events. And he was the one who insisted on laughing.
"Belief,"
Amun said.
That's what this is about?
Amund asked.
Stubborn, stubborn, slow to change, and far too big to see the need, he said.
Then he shook his head, saying,
Shit, that sounds like you and me, and particularly both of you.
6. The river's pre-catastrophe broadcasts used the ship's language, and that's what the two of them spoke now. Most of the day was invested in vain efforts at conversation. The creature didn't respond, but there was no end of noise, moving water, and the slurping of slow gelatins mixed with the chirpy whine of little creatures lurking along the shoreline. Sometimes Mir would hear what sounded like a spoken word. Or Rococo. Except no. That was imagination at play. Only one of them heard the voice, not the other. Fear and fatigue were on display and despair, the desperate mind inventing a soft hello just to feed itself that momentary dash of hope. Preset strategies were followed, but without any sense of being heard, Rococo eventually abandoned that original script. A wink to Mir, and he launched into a peculiar story about the roaring majesty of a newborn river, and how a boy stood too close and was swallowed, drowning without dying, and then left lost inside a wasteland of mud. Mir found herself listening, and then listening carefully. But just as she became intrigued by the buried head and the thoughts trapped within its mind, the story was interrupted. A clipped, clumsy sentence was offered.
I hear you, said the river.
Are you listening?
They'd asked that hours ago. Was this the river's response? And what did its timing mean? Mir had no way to answer either question. She'd never conversed directly with any river. Was the alien innately slow? Maybe those words had to be drawn from memory stored hundreds of kilometers from here. Or maybe rivers were patient, or this river was being cautious. Unless it had taken this much time to build a working mouth. Or the river wanted to ignore them entirely, and this phrase had leaked free, like a small social blunder.
I hear you,
came out from that blue-gray surface. A rather human, entirely feminine voice. Rococo quit sharing his secrets. Then the river said,
I hear you, and understand every word, and you say you need me.
We need you, Mir agreed.
You need to be somewhere else, said the river.
Rococo said, Yes.
On your great ship, said the river. But you need to cross me and stand inside your little ship. Yes, yes, yes.
Yes was an excellent word for most situations. Mir said,
Yes.
There was a pause, almost too brief to notice. Then the voice declared,
I will carry you.
It was Mir's experience that the universe was built from questions. And every question, particularly the richest few, triggered a cascade of possible answers. But she refused to push any hypothesis ahead of the others. In her work, guesses were hazards. Every insight invited belief, and nothing was more dangerous than revelation. The exobiologist never stopped fighting the impulse to frame what she was seeing. Believing the bare minimum. That was a wise strategy, and that's why she couldn't accept the river's good words or its sudden promise to help. Whatever the situation, it was time to call to Amund. The mortal hadn't moved for hours. Sitting on the high ground, he nodded down at her while pulling a hand across his mouth, as if pushing his jaw closed. Then he stood, one arm and then both arms helping him lift the backpack and kit. And as he walked down the brief hill, Mir noticed what was different about Amund. The local gravity was intense, and the man had to be tired, but she thought that she saw the beginnings of a swagger riding on those short, careful steps. The river had fallen silent. Sacks of salty water gathered on its surface, proteins inside the sacks weaving structures that quickly linked with their neighbors. Then the water was yanked away from the sacks with a shrill, keening screech, leaving behind a peculiar and mostly dry object that looked like a boat and smelled exactly like fresh meat. Mir didn't believe any good news, but Rococo was a portrait of enthusiasm. Looking back at the mortal, he shouted, "We have a yacht now!" Amund was smiling, and then he wasn't. Winking at Mir, Rococo said, "Every world looks better when you don't have to walk it. Don't you agree?" The gift was no yacht. The object resembled ancient pontoon boats, except unlike any vessel cobbled out of animal hides or spun boron, this boat would never float. Certainly not like two bottles riding on a current. The river was semi-solid and denser than water. The darkest blue flesh marbled with little white threads and spinning red wheels of light. To her bare palm, the creature was warm enough to be pleasant and a little stubborn when shoved. A person could walk across its surface, but only for as long as the river cooperated. On a whim, it could liquefy. That's what the old videos showed. Whenever it wished, the river could engulf the pontoons and platform and then everybody on board. That grim prospect had to be in Rococo's mind, too. Yet the man didn't hesitate to walk across the blueness and climb on board, practically running from one end to the other. Following warily, Mir found a wood-like platform edged with simple low rails. There were three cabins, each with a flat roof and its own walls, and one door that could be swung closed. And there was a fourth room with nothing inside but a toilet. The biggest shock was how planned everything was, functional and unadorned, yet entirely usable, perhaps even comfortable. What should the two of them offer in response? Praises and thanks, perhaps. With few hard threats against anyone who might try to set a trap. Rococo and Mir shared glances, trying to guess each other's mind. Amund had reached the shoreline. And the blue flesh rippled, pontoons rising up on newborn ridges. This must be how they would move. What wasn't a river would carry them on its wiggling skin, and what wasn't a river valley would pass on both sides. Mir didn't want to make guesses, much less fall for wrong speculations, but a sudden confidence shook away some of her doubts. She looked at Amund again. The mortal seemed to prefer the shore. Like muscle, like people, a living river preferred to find easy routes. That's why their distributions resembled earthly rivers. Born in the sea, lazy flesh was pushed wherever the climbing was easiest, which meant following existing drainages. Living tissues absorbed rain and glacial melt, as well as the minerals and every organic treat. Each creature fed on an extraordinary range of energy sources. Sunlight and wild insects were food. Infrared radiation from the ground was food. But the most coveted meals were from beneath the ocean floor and the high mountains. Piezoelectric and geothermal. That's what delivered true, trustworthy power. To Mir, this was a wonderland. Regardless of what life brought, death tomorrow or in another 10 million years, she might never experience an entity so strangely remarkable as this. That sounded like belief, didn't it? She laughed to herself. Rococo noticed, and for one reason or many, he laughed with her. Then both looked at the shoreline, at Amund. Was he going to balk at the ride? No. His hesitations ended with a few long steps across the river. Then he was standing beside them, saying nothing, letting the pack and kit fall to the deck, but breathing hard while staring at Mir. Something was different, was wrong. Possibilities offered themselves. Mir accepted none of them, but her intention was to flat out ask their companion about his mood. Except there wasn't time for questions. Looking past both of them, Amund called out, "I'm ready!" The boat that wasn't a boat shivered. "And I want this to be a quick trip," Amund commanded. Suddenly the boat rose even higher, and they were streaking downstream. Laughing, Rococo sounded like a nervous boy. Mir felt warm and afraid. Meanwhile, the man in charge seemed to relish their reactions, stepping between them as a smile came and then faded again, a slight embarrassment offered with the hard words.
For the moment, both of you are under my protection.
What was this?
And the man in charge said,
Madam, I want you to know, I'm looking forward to sleeping with you.
7. Leaving his homeworld, bound for duty aboard the great ship, the youngster envisioned his life as a sequence of long leaps through darkness, with spectacles and wonders waiting at the end. That was a self-absorbed notion, and deserved. The great ship commanded respect as well as envy, and it was in the best interest of every world to enthrall the ship's diplomats. As the ultimate tourist, Rococo was sure to be afforded every comfort, every grace. Standing on the windswept lip of an endless canyon, walking the sacred glen past the sacred desert, or, if the mood struck, riding what wasn't a whale into the depths of a frigid methane sea, those were memorable events from his first 1,000 years. But spectacle rises only so high. Even an intensely curious mind grows numb to vistas and symphonies and all of those rich, sweet stinks. And every grand majesty eventually becomes nothing but another good day. Yet this living river, the beast was like nothing else. And their journey to the coast? Without the high stakes, this voyage would have been momentous. But the perils were close and impossible to forget. Amund, for instance. The man was dying. Age was murdering him, and the omnipresent radiation and the capricious will of an alien had elevated him to a highly, utterly ridiculous station. But for how long? Meanwhile, the two immortals were stripped of every resource, nothing to aid them but considerable experience and the fact that one of them had survived worse disasters than this, which was Mir. Rococo had never experienced any mission this harrowing. But why would he? Diplomats weren't explorers. The captains didn't toss his kind into shitstorms, and in particular, they wouldn't risk Rococo, one of their best. Not for an adventure with less than 2% chance of survival. Which was his estimate, weighing what he knew and what his guts said.
2%, he mentioned to Mir.
She stared at the living river and the swiftly passing shoreline. Having outlived at least one world, he assumed she would generate a more optimistic number. But no, she surprised him. With confidence, she said,
I don't know.
It's an estimate, he allowed.
Then she warned him.
Guesses are just another danger.
And on that cryptic note, she turned away, walking into the cabin that she was sharing with the dying man. Rococo remained on the bow of what wasn't a boat. Boats were buoyant, but there was nothing to float on here. What wasn't a river carried them where it wished, and it was wishing them toward the ocean, usually at speeds that drove strong winds into his face. Everything in sight was one creature, a wonder of salt-infused gel and migrating impulses, bioelectric currents and free oxygen, plus reflexes and cross-purposed desires, and whatever memories happened to have survived the recent nightmare. Unless every memory had endured, which was possible. Who knew? A field team and labs and AI savants running free. That's what they needed. And that was impossible. This river was safe from study. And a man riding the swift non-boat couldn't understand what he was seeing, much less appreciate what he couldn't see. And that was another reason why Rococo found himself spellbound. The beast had grown wider and presumably much deeper over the last few days. More than 3 kilometers across, the blue-black gelatin appeared slick and dark and exceptionally non-reflective. Water always invited the sky. But this wasn't water. They rode on a ribbon of meat and reflex and furious power. And where true rivers were flat, this creature made itself tall, flexing into a ridge that carried tiny people and their tiny prison where it wanted, as quickly or as slowly as it wished. Now, for instance. Rococo felt the sudden change of direction. What wasn't a current swept him close to what wasn't a shoreline, and he stared at a scraggly false forest of sessile bodies waving long tendrils at him or at the sky. Maybe they were feeding on airborne plankton, or perhaps this was something else entirely. Watching the forest dance, he realized that the tip of each tendril was cracking like a whip. Bits of tissue were torn loose, and the bits rose high and then fell until wings sprouted and those new bodies flew away, dissolving into the thick alien sky. Had he seen this before? Inside the videos sent by the original river, did Rococo ever observe this talent? No. A skill unleashed during the rebuilding phase? Rococo suspected Mir would feel just as ignorant as he did. No. There was a person to ask, but he was inside his cabin with his lover. This world didn't bother speaking to diplomats or exobiologists. Only Amund was given that honor, and only on the river schedule. "Next time the two of you chat," Rococo should say, "ask about the tendrils sprouting wings, would you please?" He smiled out of habit and held tight to the railing. The river had yanked itself as high as ever. Rococo perched at the edge of what looked like a wet purple cliff, and that's when the sessile forest vanished. Busy life was instantly replaced with what looked like a dead city. Blockish shapes resembled buildings, and there were signs of fire that must have burned hotter as they continued downstream, the black outlines of foundations sketched on the blasted ground, and then long reaches of filthy irradiated glass. Cities were human inventions, and of course, this world never had cities. But a facility must have stood here. A sprawling factory where the previous river refined metals and wove the antennae that spoke to the great ship, and maybe the bones of those early starships. Maybe this was an intentional side trip, one man shown the devastation wrought by some very bad thoughts. Or maybe this was all chance. Either way, the blast zone impressed him. Rococo estimated distances and the megatons, both of which were substantial. And then the glass vanished, the river spreading into a gelatinous purple lake inside a crater, and Rococo couldn't stop thinking about what a nuclear device would do to his tiny, perpetually scared mind. Suddenly, that 2% chance of survival felt wildly optimistic. He suffered that revelation and then embraced it. Freedom always came when the odds were at their worst. There was no getting off this world. The new river didn't trust them, and maimed as it was, it had enough power to demand whatever it believed was best, and that included ignoring the two creatures that could transform its future in the most amazing ways. Holding his breath, Rococo listened to his thoughts. Far out on the lake, the beast was pulling itself into what looked like a mountain, and then it lifted the prison and prisoners until they were at the summit, hundreds of meters above the land. That's when they stopped, and a great voice rose from below, shaking the world as it called out, "Amund." A few moments passed before the naked man appeared, obviously interrupted from pleasures that didn't appreciate interruptions. Rococo continued to hold his breath, his body tingling, alternate metabolisms waking as the last of his oxygen was spent. Still naked, Amund hurried down the blue slope, and where nobody else could hear him, he paused, speaking a few words while waving his hands. Mir emerged, wearing clothes and a watchful, unreadable expression. Rococo breathed again. The sugar inside his flesh began to burn, the tingling becoming a general warmth, and once again, his thoughts shifted.
He wanted to speak to Mir. Honestly and unheard. But that meant using a tongue that the creature beneath them couldn't understand. More breathing. More thinking. The Luddy continued to wave his hands, chatting happily with one of the largest creatures in the galaxy. Rococo cleared his throat.
I'm thinking of that Baltan proverb.
The Baltan were familiar to both of them, and that included a language that this world couldn't have heard. Mir stared at him. Rococo offered a brief statement that sounded like music. Straightening her back, the woman smiled and then let the smile fall away. This hadn't been a long meeting. Amund was already returning to the prison, marching uphill because his great friend wouldn't think of making the journey easy for aging legs. How much radiation was punching up from the lake floor? Probably quite a lot. The entire world was saturated with fallout, and Amund was halfway dead, and even if the cancers didn't kill him, it was only a matter of decades before he was finished. With those bleak thoughts swirling, Rococo offered another Baltan proverb.
Doom and eggs! Doom and eggs! He sang. Our souls are the boxes that carry forth the doom and the eggs.
As he spoke, he realized that he was crying. When did the tears start? Rococo had never earned a warm smile from Mir. Until now. The tiny woman looked at him, offering a sigh while showing him such a delicious smile. She cared. She felt for him and for both of them. Perhaps she even thought about holding his hand. And there weren't enough sensors in the universe to measure the pleasure that smile delivered to one old and very doomed diplomat.